Anybody here coming back from the philosophy of evolution, part one? In the last hour, when Vladimir was speaking about the time, the mythological time, when language, the Paravak, was creating, not representing or reflecting, but creating its instruments, creating meaning. Just right at the end of the last hour, it occurred to me that in evolutionary biology today, there is a common understanding that when the human being became, when the spine became straight and the brain cavity enlarged, somewhere between 150 million years ago and 40,000 years ago, during that transition from the Australopithecine to the Cro-Magnon and eventually Homo sapiens, there was, it's thought that there was a kind of simultaneous development of the vocal cords, the jaw shape, the vocal cords, the upright spine, and the enlarged brain cavity all occurred during the same transition from Australopithecine to Cro-Magnon, Homo sapiens. So there was some, there was a process there that Darwin refers to as co-adaptation of parts. When one part changes, the other changes automatically and not necessarily as an adaptation. So there are always changes going on in species that are co-adaptations, which are not actually originally the process of an adaptation. But when one part changes because of its genetic linkages with other parts of the body, those parts also change. So the upright walking of the human being, the new shape of the head, neck, and jaw that occurred in early humans corresponded to the enlarging of the brain cavity and to the development of the vocal apparatus. All of these changes of the structure of the human being seem to be related and suited the common development of what we know now as the human being. Language development happened at about that time as well. So we might be able to imagine an early period of human history in which those mythological forces that Vladimir was just speaking about, at a time when language was still closely associated with pure meaning, that pressure that originated language from its, from the level when sound and meaning were of that large original conceptual nature prior even to ideas, that pressure of creative language was corresponded to the pressure of the formation of the whole verbal apparatus which distinguishes us so much, so absolutely, from every other species. That which is uniquely human is in fact this verbal apparatus and this larger brain that create language. So if at that mythological time there was something really happening that was not just Vedic speech, but it was the shift of the whole species towards its present state, then during that period of time, which could have been could have been 150,000 years, it could have been 200,000 years, between Australopithecine and Cro-Magnon, it was about 200,000 years. So it's conceivable that around 40,000 years ago, when language was really developing, symbolic language was developing, that that process itself could have been the result of a kind of overmind pressure that helped to bring about all of these changes in the human being, some of which were adaptive on the physical level, and some of which were adaptive on the vital level, and most of which were adaptive on the mental level. So it just struck me in that mythological description of how at one time language was a pure transmission of sounds which had generic meanings, which later on became diversified and specified as language. Something else also could have been going on at that time, because the big question in the philosophy of evolution and in the science of evolution also is, how do the major shifts, the major vertical shifts, occur? We know a lot about how the cladistic speciation occurs, and most of the science of evolution studies cladistic speciation. But how these major shifts occur between reptiles and birds, between non-mental and mental beings, how is it that Sri Aurobindo can say, as we just saw, man is characteristically a mental being? In mankind, in the human species evolution, everything is mental. There is nothing in human evolution that is not the predominantly mental. Tool making, language, but tool making of a very sophisticated sort, and language and the organization of societies. And where we left off in session one was with the occurrence of the mental being. What is it that characterizes the mental being? And it's ethical group behavior, primarily. And ethical group behavior is a product of language. So Sri Aurobindo says in the human cycle that vital behavior, the evolution of the vital in nature, is capable of sensibilities even beyond human sensibility, feelings, associations that are rich in quality, the relationships that we see among the higher mammals are relationships of integrity and feeling and awareness of a very sophisticated nature, and he says that the vital in us is capable of all of that. association, caring, remembering, anger and enthusiasm, and you know, many, many emotional traits that are characteristic of human beings are also present in the animal kingdom, and these are levels of mind involved completely in the vital. But in the human being, mind is no longer completely involved in the vital. It emerges as planning and representing and communicating values. So that's what really characterizes the human being. But at the same time that planning and inventing and creating human values occurred, language occurred in its very particular human form, and no other species has it. So I was just reflecting from this description of the origin of language, how whatever it was, whatever influenced the emergence of the human being, influenced the human being's formation on all levels. So mind emerged as the human being. Prior to that emergence, mind was totally involved. But all biologists today recognize, and as we stressed in our first session, recognize that cognition is going on at every level of speciation and evolution and behavior. Cognition is a common trait of animals, whether at the level of the one-celled animal or at the level of the hydra and the gastropod or at the level of simpler animals or complex animals. It's generally thought today that cognition is going on at the cellular level, even in the organization of all animal species, from the simplest to the most complex. Cognition is there. And so the point that was made in the series, the 12 lectures of the first series, was that Sri Aurobindo's original concept in the 20s, that mind, life, and body comprise a threefold complex, and that science would come to recognize that, has been recognized fully. Whether you're reading an ultra-Darwinian like Richard Dawkins today, or a more New Age biologist like Rupert Sheldrake, or a philosophical biologist like Conrad Lorenz, all are recognizing cognition as a fundamental feature of animal evolution. So the physical, the vital, and the mental are now fully present in scientific thinking. The vital is of the drive to reproduce and consume and organize matter. Matter is there as substratum, organic chemicals are organized by the vital principle. It's not just carbon and oxygen, it's carbohydrates that form the basis of life. But carbohydrates are created by the organization of life, by the principle of life itself. And they continue to complexify in cells, and until we have this very complex organism, the animal, who organizes all of its life activities around gathering and consuming and processing energy and reproducing itself in its pattern, autopoiesis, self-replication. That is the prime characteristic of life, its ability to replicate itself, which is genetic, no doubt, but it's, and that's very close to the physical level, but it's highly organized physical level activity, replication. And once the being is replicated, it functions in this most amazingly beautiful and complex manner that so preoccupied Aristotle. It builds its homes, it raises its young, and it transmits its traditions to its young, even at the level of bees and ants. Yes. Yeah, I'm suggesting that.
Yeah. So I like that.
And the reason why I'm suggesting that is because we had 12 lectures about evolution, and in the 12th one, we finally came to Sri Aurobindo. We did not start with Sri Aurobindo. But we came to the point of asking the question, on the basis of everything that's known about evolution, as far as we can comprehend what's known about evolution, and we went through many different biologists' and philosophers' works, the question is, can process alone account for evolution? Mechanical or vital or any kind of process. And we discussed, we read, and we saw many descriptions of the process of speciation, for example. And then when we come to the human being and confront something like language, and culture and science and so on, we recognize that language as such, language, the phenomenon of language, is so not biological, it is so not vital, it is such an extraordinary thing in itself that biological processes cannot explain it. Biological processes can explain the structures of the body that produce language. There are, in Conrad Lorenz, we find that there are many behaviors that we share with animals, including the transmission of tradition, ritual behaviors, imitation, the ability to categorize and distinguish different categories of objects, which he calls constancy phenomena. These are biological. They are present in the whole animal kingdom, practically. But, and sight. Sight is present in every species. But think about this phenomenon of sight. Seeing. and organizing your activities around the fact that you see. Bats do that, but they do it with radar. Fish and tadpoles, even, you know, they direct their movement on the basis of their ability to perceive spatial relationships. So the perception of spatial relationship and the direction of behavior based upon the perception of spatial relationship, which we call seeing, is common in the animal kingdom. But if we think about sight itself as an essential product of evolution, which, as I pointed out many times, has evolved independently in 40 different phyla, 40 different phyletic processes of descent have all created sight in different ways. So it's not an especially human mammalian trait. Sight is omnipresent. And what is sight? It's a phenomenon of perception. And what is perception? It's a phenomenon of cognition. So this evolution, as we concluded in session 12, this evolution that we're able to describe so thoroughly at every level, physical, vital, and mental, is not just an evolution of structures as biology normally thinks of it. Those structures all contribute, well, not all of them, but for the most part, they contribute to the gathering of information and the processing of information, which is on the basis of which, at every level, all the members of a species survives. It survives on the basis of the information that its structures collect and process. This is called cognition. So what's actually evolving, if we look at the development of sight or perception of any kind through from the simplest species to the most complex, it appears that what's evolving is consciousness. It appears that consciousness is not at all a product of the human brain. But consciousness is there at every level of evolution. And it, at our level, it has highly refined, coordinated sense organs and language and thought and conceptualization, but we can find the rudiments of all of those functions at all the other levels. So this is what Konrad Lorenz got the Nobel Prize for. He created the science of ethology, which showed how all of these behaviors of consciousness are present at all levels. And what really characterizes a species is its particular patterns of behavior. And those patterns of behavior are complex processes of communication, often. So, we ended our sessions with these questions. Is process enough to explain the evolution of consciousness? What is consciousness? What is mind? And then we began to look into Sri Aurobindo, because he has given us the perspective, the philosophical perspective, that says and shows us the planes of existence and how they interact. And so he says that vital phenomena are in all the many beautiful, wonderful, energetic forms that we know them, are products of the vital plane, and that vital plane has many levels, including gods and goddesses. And the mental plane, with which we are very familiar, is interacting with the vital plane to give it its qualities, many of its qualities, not all of them, but many of them. And the vital plane interacts with the physical plane to organize matter. And if mind is going to exceed itself, if it is going to exceed itself, and we look around at what mind is doing, and it is, you know, as wonderful as it is for having kept us going for a few hundred thousand years and having made us the dominant species on the planet, for all its wonders, it's also bringing us to the point of extinction. Mind is not able to solve all of its problems. And so it is beginning to ask itself, is there something more? And so I'll just show you some quotes that I put into what I have here, and what you'll find on the internet is an essay called Mind and the Philosophy of Evolution. And it is part three of an ongoing exploration of evolution, which is there on our website. Part one is called Physics and the Philosophy of Evolution. Part two is called Darwin and Sri Aurobindo. And part three is this. And what this is a transcription of three lectures from the first session. Lecture one, lecture seven, and lecture nine. I found, reviewing these, that they are particularly pertinent to what I want to undertake this time, which is an exploration of the evolution of mind and supermind. So please go to the website and read this essay, and if possible, listen to number 12, lecture number 12, which is on the website. Because lecture number 12, I find to be really a culmination of all the lectures. And everything that we need to think about in order to do this exploration is there in lecture 12, which I have not transcribed. But 1, 7, and 9 have got very essential elements of what we are discussing. And one of them comes at the end of this first section of that three-part essay, regarding the questions that we are now asking. We have philosophers of evolution like Daniel Dennett and Whitehead, one of whom says, a proper application of Darwinian thinking suggests that if we survive our currently self-induced environmental crisis, our capacity to comprehend will continue to grow by increments that are now incomprehensible to us. This Daniel Dennett is an ultra-Darwinian analytic philosopher, and he says that Darwinian thinking leads to this conclusion. In order to survive, we need to exceed ourselves. And as we exceed ourselves, what we will be able to do will be incomprehensible to us in our current state. This is an ultra-Darwinian conclusion. Well, Lecture 12 is full of those kinds of conclusions. Darwinians today are pretty far out. So I quoted a number of things in that last lecture. And then Whitehead, with whom we began the session last time, says, this planet or this nebula in which our sun is placed may be advancing toward a change in the general character of its spatial relations. Perhaps in the dim future, mankind, if it then exists, will look back to the queer, contracted, three-dimensional universe from which the nobler, wider existence has emerged. So there is a nobler, wider existence that he foresees possibly emerging from this contracted spatial mental being that we are. Not only does he see consciousness evolving, but he sees the spatial universe itself evolving. Spatial relationships are evolving. Space is evolving. And it's becoming, with Einstein, less three-dimensional already. Hardly anyone speaks of less than four these days, and many speak of 11. Many who speak about space. Not most. Most people just move around in it and try to make use of what they find there. But we know from studying Gebser, if we followed our last semester, which intervened between Evolution 1 and this one, we had another semester in between in which we pursued something called the psychology of social development. And we had a chance to look a little bit through Gebser's work, who traced the evolution of human societies from the most primitive archaic up to the most advanced rational, and predicted the emergence of an integral species of consciousness based upon the evolution of spatial and temporal consciousness. And he is able to show how spatial consciousness and temporal consciousness characterize the different stages of human evolution. And our current stage is, which transited sometime in the last 2,000 years only, into a kind of temporal consciousness that is extra spatial. And in the 20th century in particular, it seems that a major shift has occurred in our temporal consciousness. So we perceive time differently now than people did in the 15th century or in the 2nd century or in 5000 BC. Time consciousness has been evolving. So when Whitehead says that the nobler, wider existence may come about as a result of a change in spatial relations. He's touching an intuition that actually belongs probably to the integral level of consciousness, which has not manifested yet, but which we are presumably engaged in helping to happen. Because we perceive that rational spatial mind can't solve all of the problems. Life has been working on solving spatial relationships for a good long time, at least since the dinosaurs became extinct and allowed little mammals to flourish. But probably long before that, because the behavior of most animals is characterized by spatial orientation. So spatial consciousness has been evolving for a long time. The most sophisticated level, according to Gebser, is when Leonardo discovered perspectivity. Then spatial consciousness was really home. So we finally arrived around the 15th century to full-blown mental spatial consciousness. Since that time, we have been proceeding towards spatio-temporal consciousness. And we will eventually emerge into what Sri Aurobindo worked yogically on very deliberately for many years, the ability to see and function in the three times simultaneously. Now imagine what kind of an energy shift that brings about in you. If you enter into a consciousness which does not distinguish between, or it doesn't make a major distinction between the future and the present and the past, and is able to organize the present absolutely in relation to what it perceives coming in the future, whether it's 6 hours or 60 years from now, and every energy packet that's expended is expended in relationship to that vast future creation, that perpetual novelty. If perpetual novelty becomes your ever-present consciousness, imagine how your energy will be utilized. You will not be preoccupied with maintaining anything that belongs to the past anymore. It will be useless, a waste of time and energy just to repeat the past every day. Then you will be functioning on a different metabolic level. This will bring about a shift in structure. Sri Aurobindo and the Mother have spoken about this more than anyone else so far. That this is inevitable. Now that introduces a philosophical question. The presumed or hypothecated inevitability of this supramental shift. Because nobody is talking about that yet. There are some flashes of intuition indicating that the human being must shift dramatically to survive, and anyway will shift dramatically just as a product of Darwinian processes. But not very many are looking at the nature of that shift So when we begin an exploration in the philosophy of evolution called mind and supermind, what we are talking about is, what is mind? How has it evolved? What are its limits? And what might supermind be? So that's the theme of this course. And it presumes that we know already quite a lot about how mind evolved, because that's what we covered in the first series. So if you're interested in pursuing the second series, I strongly suggest that you read these excerpts and also listen to number 12, which at some point we'll get a transcription of, but it's better to listen to it, I think. Because it really is a summary of everything that was covered. And it does introduce Sri Aurobindo's conception of supermind already, but in a very tentative way. Now, I think that's all I wanted to show you with this. The three things that are covered here are that introduction to the concept of a philosophy of evolution. That's very important, I think. In there, what I've stated, I believe, more or less clearly and repeated many times, so I don't want to repeat it too much more, is the idea that a philosophy of evolution... Sorry, I'm moving this, but I'm just trying to find the break. So don't pay attention to that if you can avoid it. A philosophy of evolution has the possibility, according to Whitehead and according to others, of enabling us to participate fully in life as evolutionary beings. That's the potential of a philosophy of evolution. Because as Whitehead explains, every civilization is strongly influenced by its values. And philosophy is the statement of those values. And it is the process of grounding those values in nature, in the world that we perceive and how we perceive it, and the metaphysical and religious and social values that we are able to base on how we perceive existence. And those values that we base on how we perceive existence are formulated best by poets and philosophers. Now, if we begin to perceive nature as an evolutionary being and us as its apex, sort of, its forerunners, then perceiving ourselves and nature as evolutionary and developing a philosophy based upon that perception should enable us, energize us, position us in nature to understand our role as evolutionary beings, not just mental beings. So Bergson and Sri Aurobindo sort of started this, and Whitehead started this process, and I had a number of quotes in that section, second section from Bergson that it would be very useful to review. Bergson was able to say in 1907, all the living hold together, and all yield to the same tremendous push. The animal takes its stand on the plant, and bestrides, man bestrides animality, and the whole of humanity in space and in time is one immense army galloping beside and before and behind each of us in an overwhelming charge, able to beat down every resistance and clear the most formidable obstacles, perhaps even death. So we know that Sri Aurobindo's whole philosophy and yoga is based upon the conception that the supramental descent and its evolution in the threefold complex will ultimately make possible the conquest of death. So he has actually given us a process for achieving that which Bergson intuited about 7 years before Sri Aurobindo started writing The Life Divine. That's a kind of concurrence of consciousness awakening. Then the last section of these three is the one that focuses on Conrad Lorenz's work in the 70s. Whitehead gives us the he instigates us to realize that a philosophy of evolution would identify those values in our civilization that are the highest and most needed for our understanding and of things and our survival. Bergson comes along, and they were both very close to each other, but Bergson ignited Whitehead, and Whitehead refers often to Bergson, who identified the whole movement of life as a movement of consciousness. Then Sri Aurobindo grasped the process for transforming consciousness from the mental, whose limits had been defined by Bergson, into its next potential. The process of transforming it was grasped by him and set in motion. And that's what we feel in our atmosphere here. From time to time, pumping in another quality of perception of force. But is that enough? Is it enough for us to know that there's a process of evolution going on in nature that we're a part of, and that there's a force in the atmosphere that's somehow essentially related to that process? Is that enough? So now we can go home and drink tea and wait for the supramental being to emerge. Confidently, right? Or did Sri Aurobindo spend 40 years writing philosophy and poetry about evolution for some reason? Is there something there that's essential? Besides just knowing that evolution occurs and there's a new force in the atmosphere. Was that the sole purpose of all of that writing? Or wasn't it perhaps, since it originated with Rig Veda, wasn't it perhaps a way of channeling that power itself? Isn't Savitri about manifesting that power? Isn't that really what Savitri is about? It's not an epic poem. It's a yogic power. So, on Wednesday nights, we're going to be focusing on Savitri again. With this idea, what is it really? And what does it mean really? Because if poetry and philosophy, according to Whitehead, if they are in fact the very best human means for establishing values and the forms of expression of those values, then isn't it possible that Sri Aurobindo's poetry and philosophy are the beginning of the expression of values that belong to that next evolution? And not at all about mental philosophy and epic poetry. But in fact, all about supramental values and forces and consciousness. Because, as he says, there is a mechanism, and that mechanism requires that the mind be put directly into contact with the higher mind and overmind energies. And putting the mind in contact with those energies is what makes the descent possible. So in the synthesis of yoga, which I have here, maybe I'll save that for next time. Some people are ready.
Some, very few.
So let's get ready.
I am ready.
Let's go. That's why we're coming here.
Yes, sure.
But
is it enough? No.
So getting ready, that's a good beginning.
The anecdote in the ashram about Nobel's supplemental descent is coming. Who is ready? There is only one person. It's Ananda's lady's father.
Okay, so I was planning to read a couple of paragraphs from this book, which instead of putting on the screen, because that takes time, I think I would just like to read to you, if you don't mind. It's just a paragraph to address this idea that we were just speaking about. He's speaking about mental concentration. He says, to use this means for unification with the divine is the condition. What? No, I told you, I'm going to have to hunt around for it because the page numbers aren't the same. And I can probably find it, but let me see if I... Let's see if it happens here.
Take one of the key phrases.
Yeah, I'm going to take a key phrase. Given the self-determination... Oh, but it didn't open the find. Try another one. Given the self-determination. Given the self-determination. Yeah, it's the beginning of a sentence. I did. It should be around page 300, so it missed it.
Make self-determination alone.
This one worked a while ago. I don't know what's the difference. Did I miss the capital again?
Yes, again.
Well, I did capital. Not working. Anyway, it would work if I spent lots of time. I just wanted to read a short paragraph. He says, this mental concentration is the condition. This concentration proceeds by the idea. I just gave you lots of ideas about evolution. Evolution of consciousness, that's a big idea, capital I. Supramental manifestation, big idea. This concentration proceeds by the idea, using thought. Using thought, form, and name. This is Tantra. As keys, which yield up to the concentrating mind the truth. Capital T, that lies concealed behind all thought. We have this kind of superficial mental chitta going on, but behind all of that, there is the truth. Concentration can yield it up if you concentrate on the right forms, names. For it is through the idea that the mental being rises beyond all expression to that which is expressed, to that of which the idea itself is only the instrument. So there's a being evolving here. the true human being, even, forget the supermind for the moment, the true human being is also there, behind all of the nonsense. The divine will, otherwise called the psychic being, is there, behind all the vital will and the physical will and the mental will. The divine will is there behind, which Sri Aurobindo wants us to find by concentration on the idea, but not the mental idea. Idea has another meaning than the empirical one. So this is a course in philosophy, and we will discuss the difference between the empirical idea of the idea and the spiritual idea of the idea. For it is through the idea that the mental being, that's us, rises beyond all expression to that which is expressed, to that of which the idea itself is only the instrument. By concentration upon the idea, the mental existence, which at present we are, breaks open the barrier of our mentality. That's active. This is not a passive meditation. We'll see a lot of this on Wednesday night. Sri Aurobindo has demonstrated how that happens in Canto 5 of Book 1, step by step. And arrives at the state of consciousness, the state of being, the state of power of conscious being, and bliss of conscious being, to which the idea corresponds, and of which it is the symbol, movement, and rhythm. Now, who has written a symbol, a movement, and a rhythm of the idea that conveys that? Written it. That's what yoga mantra is. Concentration by the idea is then only a means, a key to open to us the superconscient planes of our existence. Philosophy and poetry are only a means. A certain self-gathered state of our whole existence lifted into that superconscient truth. Self-aware, self-blissful existence is the aim and the culmination. The culmination of what? The culmination of practice. What kind of practice? The practice of concentrating on the idea using thought, form, and name. Yoga mantra. It's a tantric practice. It's the core of Sri Aurobindo's yoga. The divine word. It has many, many forms. Philosophy is one of them also. Fundamental one. To arrive then at this settled divine status must be the object of our concentration. The first step in concentration must be always to accustom the discursive mind to a settled, unwavering pursuit of a single course of connected thought. It's not up there. I'm reading it from here. I'm going to close this so that you're not tempted to think that it's up there.
No, I'm not looking for anything.
Okay.
It's
okay.
A difficult thing to do there.
Okay.
Inactive thought. So there is no thought and there is a thought.
Okay, this is the first step. This is the step towards no thought.
Step towards?
This is a step towards no thought, which is a step towards higher thought, which is a step towards no thought, again, at another level. The first step must be always. These words have meaning. To accustom the discursive mind, which you're now using to think with, to accustom the discursive mind, the mind which discusses around the points, to a settled, unwavering pursuit of a single course of connected thought. That's philosophy. And it can be very effective. And this it must do undisturbed. And this it must do undisturbed. In the stillness, not distracted, no doubt. Well, next week I'm going to go into it. So you want to read it in between?
I want to read it in between because yesterday I was discussing with Shraddha and I didn't get all of what he was saying.
Okay, I just took the page mark out. No, but I wrote it down. I think it's 320.
Yeah, you said this is 300. You know the chapter? The name of the chapter?
I'm going to give it to you right now. Um, 306 in the old edition, page 306, last paragraph, and the first paragraph of the next page, and then all of the next two pages. So 306 to 308.
And the name of, because you say the old edition, I have a new one.
Synthesis of Yoga.
Yeah, I have the new edition.
Well?
Same?
No.
No,
it's not the same.
The chapter, the perfection, no, it's not the perfection.
That's why I was having trouble finding it, because they are not the same.
Okay. But what is the name of the...
Concentration.
Concentration, good. So.
Chapter 4.
Question 4. Okay, I will find it.
Part 2.
Part 2. Thank you very much.
Okay.